the conversation on debt, and we've been talking about this with the Economics of Compassion Initiative. And as I thought about what to share with you tonight, whenever the word debt comes to mind for me, I end up going to Randall Robinson, who wrote a book entitled The Debt That America Owes. And I can't escape this conversation on debt without going to that book and the premise of that book. And the premise of that book is that America owes African Americans, and not only America, but Europe as well, the descendants of slaves, African slaves, America owes a tremendous debt. It is not just an economic debt, but it is a moral debt. And so I want to take Walter's words and march them up to the 21st century. When I read the Hebrew text, I never stay there. I don't read the Hebrew text as a Middle Eastern history book. I read it as the living word of God. And if it can't be marched up to the 21st century, then I really don't know what to do with it. I never will forget, when my youngest son was 12 and one of his friends was having his bar mitzvah, and so we went. It was my first bar mitzvah, even though I grew up in North Avondale, predominantly black Jewish community, first time ever attending a bar mitzvah. And I thought in the black church you did a lot of standing up and sitting down. The bar mitzvah was long, stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down. And the little boy who went to school with my son, he as he was reading parts of the Torah, and he said, I'm going to be the best Jew I can be. I'm going to be the best Jew I can be. And we were at Rockdale Temple. And so afterwards, I was walking around with the rabbi, and he kept saying, Damon, you know, in our book, we believe this. In our book, it says this. And it finally clicked to me what he was trying to tell me. You know, I'm here in this Christian church, and we have this, you know, big old Bible with 66 books, and we claim it all. But he was saying, Damon, this is really our book. I mean, you guys got a book too, but in our book, I said, all right, I get the message. I understand. So what I do is I take that book, and I use it as a launching pad to see what the God of Israel had done and what he still can do, what God still can do. So let's take the narrative that Walter shared with us and march it up to the 21st century, that 400-year period, that part of the Exodus. And I want to point out to you the problem with the people that you see right now in the streets of Ferguson, the people that you've seen in the streets of Baltimore, the angry young black men and women and others that you see marching in Cleveland, you could very well see marching in the streets of Cincinnati. And I want to introduce you to them and tell you exactly who they are. And maybe if we understand that, we'll understand the debt that America owes. Listen to this. This is from the book entitled The Debt. It says, let us picture one representative individual whose debt-in crisis in contemporary America symbolizes the plight of millions. At various times in his life, he's likely to be in jail, unemployed, or badly educated, or sick from a curable ailment, or dead from violence. What happened to him, and from what did he or she emerge? This is the story. His great-great-grandfather was born a slave and died a slave. Great-great-grandfather's labors enriched not only his white southern owners, but also shipbuilders, sailors, rope makers, calkers, and countless other northern businesses that served and benefited from the cotton trade built upon slavery. Great-great-grandfather had only briefly known his mother and father before being sold off from them to plantation miles away. He had no idea where in Africa his people had originally come from, what language they had spoken or customs they had practiced. Although certain Africanisms, falsetto singing, the ring shout, and words like yam had survived, he did not know their origins were African. He was, of course, compulsory illiterate. His days were trials of backbreaking work and physical abuse with no promise of relief. He had no past and no future. He scratched along only because some biological instinct impelled him to survive. His son, today's black male's great-grandfather, today's black male is the young man you see in Ferguson on the streets or Baltimore. His son, today's black male's great-grandfather, was also born in slavery, and like his father, wrenched so early from his parents that he could scarcely remember them. At the end of the Civil War, he was 19 years old. While he was pleased to no longer be a slave, he was uncertain that the new status would yield anything in real terms that was very much different from the life, if you could call it that, that he had been living. He too was illiterate and completely without skills. He was one of 4 million former slaves wandering rootlessly around in the defeated South. He trusted no whites, whether they were North or South. He had heard during the war that even President Lincoln had been urging blacks upon emancipation to leave the United States en masse for colonies that would be set up in Haiti and Liberia. In fact, Lincoln had invited a group of free blacks to the White House in August 1862 and told them, "Your race suffers greatly, many of them by living among us, while ours suffers from your presence. In a word, we suffer on each side. If this is admitted, it affords a reason why we should separate." Today's black male's great-grandfather knew nothing of Haiti or Liberia, although he had a good idea why Lincoln wanted to ship blacks to such places. By 1866, his life had remained a trial of instability and rootlessness. He had no money and little more than pickup work. He and other blacks in the South were faced as well with new laws that were not unlike the antebellum slave codes. The new measures were called black codes. And as John Hope Franklin noted in From Slavery to Freedom, they all but guaranteed that the control of blacks by white employers was about as great as that which slaveholders had exercised. Blacks who quit their job could be arrested and in prison. Although some blacks received land in the South under the Southern Homestead Act of 1866, the impression that every slave, ex-slave, would receive 40 acres and a mule as a gift of the government never became a reality. Great-grandfather, like the vast majority of the 4 million former slaves, received nothing and died penniless in 1902, but not before producing a son who was born in 1890 and later became the first of his line to learn to read. 2 decades into the new century, having inherited nothing in the way of bootstraps with which to hoist himself and faced with unremitting racial discrimination, grandfather became a sharecropper on land leased from whites whose grandparents had owned at least one of his forebearers. The year was 1925, and neither grandfather nor his wife was allowed to vote. His son would join him in the cotton fields under the broiling sun of the early 1930s. They worked 12 hours or more a day and barely eked out a living. Grandfather had managed to finish the 5th grade before leaving school to work full time. Inasmuch as he talked like the people he knew and like his parents and their parents before them, his syntax and pronunciation bore the mark of the unlettered. Grandfather wanted badly that his son's life not mirror his, but was failing depressingly in producing for the boy any better opportunity than that which he himself had been presented. Not only had he no money, but he survived against the punishing strictures of Southern segregation that allowed for blacks the barest leavings in education, wages, and political freedom. He was trapped and afraid to raise his voice against a system that in many respects resembled slavery, now a mere 70 years gone. Grandfather drank and expressed his rage in beatings administered to his wife and his son. And in the early 1940s, grandfather disappeared into a deep depression and never seemed the same again. Grandfather's son, the father of today's black male, periodically attended segregated schools, first in a rural area near the family's leased cotton patch, and later in a medium-sized segregated southern city. He learned to read passably, but never finished high school. He was not stigmatized for this particular failure because the failure was not exceptional in the world in which he had known. Ingrained low expectation, when consciously faced, invites impenetrable gloom. Thus, father did not dwell on the meagerness of his life's chances. Any penchant he may have had for introspection, like his father before him, he drowned in corn spirits on Friday nights. He was a middle-aged laborer who had never been on a first-name term with anyone who was not a laborer like himself. He worked for whites, and as far as he could tell, everyone in his family before him had. Whites had to him the best of everything: houses, cars, schools, movie theaters, neighborhoods. Black neighborhoods, he could tell from simply looking at them, even before he saw the people. It was not just that the neighborhoods were poor. No, he had subconsciously likened something inside himself, a jagged rent in his ageless black soul, to the sagging wooden tenement porches laden with old household objects, ladders, empty flower pots, wagons that rested on them, often wrong side up for months at a time. The world hadn't bothered to notice. Father died of heart disease at the age of 45, just before the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Like his ancestors who had lived and died in slavery in centuries before, he was never allowed to cast a vote in his life. Little else distinguished his life from theirs, save a subsistence wage, the freedom to walk around in certain public places, and the ability to read a newspaper, albeit slowly. Parallel lines never touch, no matter how far in time and space they extend. They had been declared free, 4 million of them. Some had simply walked off plantations during the war in search of Union forces. Others became brazenly outspoken to their white masters toward the war's conclusion. Some had remained loyal to their masters to the end, abandoned, penniless, and unskilled to the mercies of a humiliated and hostile South. Millions of men and women and children trudged into the false freedom of Jim Crow South with virtually nothing in way of recompense, preparation, or even national apology. It is from this condition that today's black male emerged. The black male is far more likely than his white counterpart to be in prison, to be murdered, to have no job, to fail in school, to become seriously ill. His life will be shorter by 7 years. His chances of finishing high school smaller, 74% as opposed to 86% for his white counterpart. Exacerbating an already crushing legacy of slavery-based social disabilities, he faces fresh discrimination daily in modern America. In the courts, he is 10 times more likely to be in prison than his white counterpart for the same offense. If convicted on a drug charge, he will likely serve a year more in prison than his white counterpart for the same charge. While he and his fellow black males constitute 15% of the nation's drug users, they make up 33% of the arrests for drug use and 57% of those convicted. And then they die sooner and at higher rates of chronic illnesses like AIDS, hypertension, diabetes, cancer, stroke, and heart disease. Saddest of all, they have no clear understanding of why such debilitating fates have befallen them. There were no clues in their public school education, no guideposts to the popular culture. Theirs was the now culture. They felt no impulse to look behind for causes. I share that because the greatest debt owed is the debt that America and Europe owe to the descendants of Africans who were brought into slavery. And it's hard to pay a debt when, first of all, you don't even acknowledge that you owe it. And it's hard to pay a debt. Well, first, if you don't acknowledge you owe it, you can't pay it. And secondly, you can't be forgiven of it if you don't even acknowledge it. And so as you walk up the time, I hear all the time, and I'm an avid watcher of Fox News. I love it to death. I really do. I do. And I hear this term, American exceptionalism, American exceptionalism. So finally, I said, let me Google this. Let me go to Wikipedia and find out what is this American exceptionalism idea. And it's the idea that America is the greatest nation that ever was, ever will be. We are the greatest. And some may very well feel that way. But when you look at the history of African Americans in this country, if it is so that we came here in 1619, the first 20 came in 1619, landed in a place called Jamestown, Virginia, on a Dutch slave ship called the Man of War. From 1619 to 1863, 244 years, the first 244 years were slavery. And so, excuse me if I don't really feel exceptional. The first 244 years, slavery, ended in 1863, 1865 for others. The next 100 years, from 101 years to be exact, from 1863 to 1964, with the passage of the Civil Rights Act, segregation. So the first 3.5 centuries of black people in this country were either slavery or segregation. And for those of us born and raised in the North, don't think that we escaped that, because segregation was in the North as well. Some of you know the names of Marion Spencer and Donald Spencer, who fought to get Coney Island just to allow black people to swim in the swimming pool. Some of you, many of you, probably graduated from Walnut Hills High School or Withrow High School, one of these great high schools that allowed black people to swim on Friday. Okay? And then after they swam, they would empty the pool and then fill it back up on Monday. This is not Alabama. I'm talking Cincinnati. The first 3.5 centuries of black people's existence in this country were slavery or segregation. After that, from 1964 to where we are now, about 51 years or so, you deal with the tremendous prison pipeline. You deal with the tremendous disparities in the criminal justice system. So it has not been a picnic. And there is a tremendous debt. The wealth that was gained on 246 years of free labor. Who wouldn't be the greatest country if you can work a group of people for free for 246 years and build wealth? And then at the end of that, say, you're free to go. In the scripture, Jesus Christ says one day that the laborer is worthy of their wages. And then you say you're free to go with no discussion of restitution, indemnification, reparations. You're just free to go. And not only free to go, and now you need to catch up. Catch up. You've got, you know, from 1964, Civil Rights Act, 1965, Voter Rights Act. It's now 2015. Damon, haven't you caught up by now? How do you catch up when somebody has a 350-year head start? The damage done, and why you see those faces you see on your nightly news of young black people in the streets of Ferguson, in the streets of Baltimore, in the streets of Cincinnati, the damage done and with 246 years, which is different. If you ask people today, in the last 500 years, what is the greatest human rights offenses that have ever been done to humankind? People may mention the Holocaust. They may mention Pol Pot. They may mention Rwanda. A lot of different things. And there have been a lot of different tremendous human rights problems and human rights massacres in the last 500 years. But they rarely mention what happened to the Native American. Amen. And rarely mention what happened to the African Americans, to the Africans. The Holocaust and what the Jewish community and the Jews went through, there's like a strong 12-year period where the Nazis were just horrendous. 12-year period. What happened in Rwanda, there's a period, there's years. But nobody, other than the people that Walter talked about, went through 246 years. It is hard to compare 246 years of oppression and then add another 100 years on top of that to anything else that has ever happened except the story that Walter brought to us today. And one of the main differences why blacks and why the question is still raised in America, what do we do with our Negro problem? Question is still being raised in this country. Is that in most of those other massacres that took place, The people to whom it took place were able to go back and recoup their culture, their heritage, their religion. And so while they suffered greatly at the hands of the despots, they didn't lose who they were. As I stand here today, I have no clue. No clue about where I come from. Most African Americans think that our history started in 1619. That's as far back as we know. Because they didn't teach us anything in school about that. They didn't teach us that we had a history beyond 1619. And so if your history starts in 1619, it starts with struggle, slavery, and comes up to segregation, and then comes up to all these other issues. We have no idea. So America and Europe, they owe a tremendous debt that has never been acknowledged, let alone paid, and hard to forgive. Because it is extremely hard to forgive those who don't even acknowledge that they owe. So when we raised the question, who are those young, angry people in the streets of Baltimore and Ferguson? They are the great-great-great-grandsons of that black man who was on the plantation who never learned to read. They are the great-great-grandsons of that black man who never was able to vote and was never paid for their wages. So how do we, I mean, one of the reasons, you know, when I watch Fox, when they're really, you know, trying to down the president, talk about the national debt, they have this debt clock. You ever seen this debt clock they have? And it's just ticking, ticking, ticking. The debt's every second, the debt is, you know, just rising. Well, there's a debt clock. And I wrote it right here. There's no statute of limitations, legally or morally, that extinguishes this clock. The book never closes on the massive, unredressed social wrongs. So let me say that again. There's no statute of limitations, legally or morally, on this debt clock. So even as we sit here today, and you know, I've heard it many times, and some of you may have very well said it. Well, that was my great-great-great-great-grandfather who did that, not me. Why should I have to pay? And I say that was my great-great-great-grandfather who that it was done to. And we should be paid. Because the debt clock never stops. And this gulf will never be breached or will never be fixed. Do you know that the average wealth, and Michelle Graves is here, and I'm sure she can back me up, the average net worth of white Americans in this country is like $140,000. The average net worth of African Americans in this country is $11,000. And it just gets wider. And it goes all the way back. All the way back. So when we talk about debt, there is a debt. It's a moral debt that America and Europe owe, and they know how to pay. I mean, if I take time and talk to you about many others who have gotten reparations, and for those who say, well, you know, isn't it kind of late? Every year, John Conyers puts before Congress a bill. He said, just to research it, not even asking for anything. Sometimes they say, just an apology. So we can't even get an apology for it. And having one black family living in a White House doesn't make up for it. Doesn't make up for it. So it's more than For me to stand up here and talk about forgiving student loan debt, and that would be great. Consumer debt, that would be great. You know, canceling out everybody's credit score, give everybody 800, that would be great. But it's actually deeper than that. It's morally deeper than that. The psychological pain and the psychological damage done to Africans in this country is deeper than just canceling their debt. Because the damage is mental. The damage is damage of the soul. And it's damage that probably every black person in this country feels on a daily basis. Even though we smile, and even though we work, and even though a few are doing extremely well, it is in the heart, it is in the soul. How we deal with that, I don't know. I think we have to begin with the truth. Jesus said, if you know the truth, it will set you free. We have to begin by accepting the truth, teaching the truth in our churches, in our synagogues, in our schools. We have to raise a generation who knows themselves, where they come from, and their roots don't start in Jamestown, Virginia. They have much deeper roots than that. My finally is this. I had dinner one day with a friend, Marco Marsan. And we went to Marco's house. Marco's Italian. And I just loved it. Because I sat there, my wife and I went, and it was so cultural. I mean, I love the fact that they knew where they came from. And they had this great Italian family. And I'm just sitting there like, man, this is great. And I wish I had the same thing. Now, it's not that I don't have a family, don't have a black family rooted in the South and, you know, that whole Southern thing. But this went a little deeper than that. You know, I didn't know until somebody sent me something in the mail that Lynch was Irish. I had no idea. I'm Damon Lynch. And I'll start getting this mail. Do you want to buy a mug from, you know, you're Irish? I got depressed. I'm like, how in the hell am I Irish? You know, so I'm stuck with this Irish last name. That doesn't mean anything to me. So the debt is real. The debt is unpaid. Whether or not it can be forgiven, I don't know. But I think it needs to be acknowledged. So I ask you to read Randall Robinson's book, it's The Debt That America Owes. And it's a good read. And then maybe one day we can discuss it together. Thank you.